accession number 25206, real one.
Could you just say something again?
Now is the time for all good men to...
That's wonderful. Yes. Graham Allen, Real One. Can you tell me first of all where you were born?
Yes, Jersey, Channel Islands.
Mm-hmm. And what did your father do?
Well, my father was the manager of a small import-export business which exported tomatoes and potatoes from Jersey to the mainland in the early part of the summer. In the winter, they imported coal. But before that, he had 22 years in the army, in the ranks, in the King's Own Royal Regiment. And he'd been a bandsman and was retired in 1919.
And did your mother work?
My mother worked before she was married, yes. She worked in the local big department store, but not after she was married she married in 1915, and then they were reunited after the war.
Right. And did you have any siblings?
Yes, I have one sister, still going, who was born in 1919.
Mm-hmm. And where did you go to school?
Well, I went to school in an elementary school in Jersey, and then I went to Victoria College, which is the local semi-public school there. Now, that was quite that had a profound effect on my future career, as it happens, because in Victoria College, there was a special scholarship which had been set up by a local millionaire called T.B. Davis. T.B. Davis was a man who had made his fortune in South Africa and had one of these enormous racing yachts. His was called the Westwood, and he used to race it at Cowes in the intervening years, in the 30s, against King George V in his yacht. And T.B. Davis was quite a character. But his only son had been killed in the First World War, Howard Leopold Davis, and he'd set up a scholarship, amongst a lot of other things, which was for Jersey boys, not girls then, Jersey boys who wanted to serve in the Imperial service, to have all the training and help they needed to do so, whether they had their own funds or not. It was chiefly to help those who did not, of course. Well, you didn't have to take an examination. You were just sort of interviewed, and if you were a likely lad, they accepted you. And I was accepted at the age of about 14 or 15, and on the basis that, yes, I would very much like to serve in the Air Force, I thought at the time, in the Air Force. And they were prepared, therefore, to help me to take the examinations for a commission in the Air Force. But as it happened, it didn't work out quite like that. So the Davis Fund was very useful to me, because by the time the war began in 1939, all permanent commissions to the Air Force were stopped. But the ones which were not, the only service which was still open to, you might say, special entry cadets, was the Navy. And I thought, well, perhaps I would be quite keen to go in the Navy, being a very ignorant young man, as you can imagine, at the age of 17. And so I put myself down to take the civil service examination for the Navy. Now, in 1940, in May 1940, of course, the Germans made their big breakthrough. And this was a tremendous shock to the Channel Islands, because, as you can imagine, hitherto the war had seemed a tremendously long way away. And in 1914-18, I mean, the war never came anywhere near the Channel Islands. But, of course, it was soon evident in 1940 that the Germans had reached Calais, were coming down the coast, and within a few weeks would be at St. Malo, 15 miles away. So there was a tremendous amount of anguish, you might say, in the whole of the island. What to do? There were farmers, of course, who were going to stay where they were. Plenty of islanders who decided they would stay where they were. Plenty of people who had English connections. The decision had to be made, really. Were you going to leave the island? In which case you could take a suitcase, lock the front door and leave your home just like that. Or were you going to stay? Well, in our family, my father and mother decided to stay. My mother had all her relations there, and I think she didn't want to leave her home. But my sister and I decided we were going to leave. And so she got out on one boat, I got out on a potato boat, and I took the examination for the civil service a few days later at Shrewsbury School, actually, and passed and was interviewed, and I was accepted as a cadet in the Navy. Now, I had chosen to go into the Royal Indian Navy, which was quite a rather unusual, because I knew that in the Navy, I had been informed, you could not live on your pay at that time. And my father had no means of his own. He was in a small way. And so, but the Davis Scholarship was behind me. But nevertheless, I thought the thing to do was go into the Indian Navy, which sounded very interesting, and also you could live on your pay. So I put down for the Indian Navy as my first choice and got it. But I went off my cadet training, and which was going to be with the RN anyway, as all Indian Navy and these cadets all went through the Royal Naval System first.
So where did you go for your training then?
Well, normally a cadet in the Navy would have gone to HMS Frobisher, which was a seagoing ship, and you had about a year or year and a half cruising around the Mediterranean, or something in the Frobisher, learning to be a young officer. But all this was stopped and due to the war, and we were sent to Dartmouth, where a wing of the college was made available to the special entry cadets. We were all a bit older than the Dartmouth intake, who we regarded as very junior. And however, so we didn't have much to do with them, but we did a concentrated 4 months course, or 3 months course, from September till the middle part of December.
So tell me about arriving at Dartmouth. I mean, did you know much about the Navy?
No, nothing at all, really. I knew I had to get a uniform, so I was referred to the right place to go, which was Gieves. Gieves supplied the uniform for everybody in the Navy, all the naval officers, it seems. All North Bros, but everybody thought Gieves was the place. And they kitted me out with what was required, and I had to... I had to make my way down to Dartmouth. Now, the thing which worried me most as a... I was 18 then. The thing which really worried me most was that I didn't know how to salute. And I thought this could be embarrassing. You see, I had been in the cadet corps, or the OTC, at school, and you'd learned the army methods, and I knew what an army salute was like, but I didn't know what a naval salute was like. As you know, the army salute is with a flat of the hand towards the front, and the naval salute is with the flat of the hand turned down, you see. So I was rather embarrassed. I thought, supposing I'm in the train and along comes an officer, then I should sort of salute. And what do I do, you see? Well, anyway, that was pretty ridiculous now, but that's what I thought at the time. I didn't meet an officer. Anyway, it didn't matter. And we got to Dartmouth, where we were put into long barracks, long halls, long bedrooms, with nothing, no beds, of course. You had a chest of drawers, and you had wires above the floor, about 8 feet up. And there were some poles to which you secured your hammock. And so the first instruction was how to put your hammock up and how to get into it. And how to get out of it, which was, we soon got the hang of that. And it was great fun. We very much enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. Everybody, I think, enjoyed the time there because when we had any time off, we could go boating on the Dart. And, of course, nights were interrupted often because this was the time of the Blitz over London and Plymouth was being severely bombed. And we were always being turned out for air raids and things. But, the war passed us by completely. You would have thought, perhaps, that the Germans would have thought, well, there's a naval college full of the intake, so we might plaster that, but not a bit of it.
What were the other chaps like? I mean, had you come from all over the place, or were they
mostly... Well, most of them were English, ex-public school. Mm-hmm. It was known as the special... That was the system then. You see, you went to a public school... If you went into what was then called the army class, which groomed you for this particular examination, and which I must say was not very arduous, and then you went into these various services, of which I might say there were scores. You see, you could go into the Army, Navy, Air Force, you'd go into the Naval Paymasters, Executive Branch, Engineering, Royal Engineers, Regiments. You see, there were large numbers of them. Rhodesian Air Force, South African Police, they were all over the world, as you see, and of course you could pick and choose, and it's a fine sort of outdoor relief system for young men in those days. Anyway, we very much enjoyed our times there. It was a lot of fun. There were English boys, I say, most of them, but we also had a contingent of Canadians who brought a breath of fresh air into the place, I can tell you. They were much less deferential and much more, a little bit older and full of go.
Yeah. So what did they teach you there? Did you have a sort of mixture of practical and...
Oh, mostly there? Practical, you see. We'd done, everybody got up to certain mathematical standards, so we learnt navigation and seamanship and signals and, Morse code and semaphore and how to behave yourself in the Navy and... a general sort of grounding in nautical matters, which I found, was great fun.
So, what idea did you have at that stage? I mean, the war was on as to what you might be doing.
Well, you knew that you would be sent off, as soon as you'd finished that, you'd graduate as a midshipman, and you'd go off to, a ship. So the interesting thing was, I wonder which ship I'll get, you see.
Did you have an ambition? Did you want to go on a destroyer or...
No, I didn't really, because it didn't really make any difference. I mean, I didn't know really what the advantages or disadvantages of them were. And so one day, really, I was quite sort of phlegmatic about it. Some boys who came from naval families declared that they... they wanted to do this, but you wouldn't normally have been sent as a midshipman to a destroyer, you see, because you weren't experienced enough. So it was either battleships or cruisers. And so we had to just wait and see what happened, So by the December, we graduated. And we knew which, and we were there. We received a notice from the Lords of the Admiralty to say to where we'd been posted. You see.
Do you remember any of the staff at Dartmouth?
Yes. I only remember the CO, who was a passed over lieutenant commander, a gentleman who was obviously a little bit soured in his view, because if you would reach 2.5 in the Army, in the Navy, and you weren't going to get any further, you tended to be a bit sort of gloomy about life. He was a lugubrious chap, and said to us, you're in the Navy now. And we all said, yes, sir. The people who, of course, did the training were petty officers and chief petty officers. And I always remember lining up the first day there, and this petty officer gunner's mate lining up in front and saying, "Now then," he says, "when I tells you to move, you don't run, see? You fly!" So we understood we had to get a move on.
How did they treat you? Do they treat you sort of respectfully, or do they expect a lot of you? You know, do they put the pressure on?
Right, who are the petty officers?
Yeah.
Oh, very much, you know, sir, you do not get out of your charge, sir. You see, so it was very much, they knew that you knew they were in charge of you, and they knew they were petty officers, and you were going to be officers, but there was no doubt about who was giving who was calling the shots, you see. And in fact, it's a very good system. It works very well, the backbone of all the services are the non-commissioned officers, and those who have the right approach and they train the youngsters and tell them what to do, and they always call them sir, but you know where the experience lies.
Was it a difficult course?
No, it wasn't. No, I couldn't say it was. I mean, I didn't think so. Nobody really did. We all wondered how well we'd pass out, and you know, there were. It wasn't a difficult course. It was to an 18-year-old who's released from school, and you know, it was all quite exciting, I thought, and. There were problems, of course, and there was a certain amount of, I suppose, backbiting among certain boys, but nothing serious, you know, just an ordinary high-spirited 18-year-old.
Mm-hmm. Any bullying?
Not very much. Excuse me. Not very much. There was, there were one or two boys who I remember were so keen types, you see. Obviously keen sort of to do so well that they really got other boys' backs up. And so when we had the final passing out, there was a certain amount of, turning around and dousing them in the showers, that sort of thing. But nothing wrong, nothing serious. Not the sort of, I mean, it might get you a serious reprimand from the powers that be nowadays, but it was all, nobody lost any sleep over it then, I think.
So, December 1940, you pass out.
So, December 1940, I passed out. And my sister, who had left Jersey at the same time as I did, had married her fiancé, who was an English lad who had worked in Jersey and who had promptly left in 1939 and joined the Air Force. She moved to England, of course, and she joined him. And in the end of 1940, she married him. So they were stationed. He was in the Coastal Command, and they were stationed alternately at St Andrews in Scotland and Aldergrove in Northern Ireland, in Coastal Command flying. And they had a little house in St Andrews. And they asked me up for my Christmas leave, 2 weeks' leave. I could go and spend with them, which was ideal. And so I remember that leave was introduced to the Air Force mess, and they had their planes, which were twin-engined Hudsons, terrible things. And they took me up for a flight. With their and met all the people there. It was great fun, and two or three flights, and it was very nice, and we had Christmas together. And then her husband Sydney was moved to Aldergrove. Well, he hadn't been there 2 days when he was killed taking off, and my sister was widowed after 6 weeks marriage, and I had to do my best to console her. She was very, very supportive, of course, in the RAF. All the officers' wives and people helped. But it was pretty tough, because then, soon after that, I had to go to join my ship, you see. And I might say, just apropos, that she realized she couldn't sit around, and she got over it, of course, and joined the Wrens, where she did very well, and spent the rest of the war in the Wrens. Anyway, so I went back to London to collect all my kit, I think it was, and then I went to join my ship, which was the King George V at Scarpa Flow. Now, it was the custom for midshipmen often to be sent to a different ship from their proper ship, you might say, for the first 2 or 3 weeks, just so they could learn their way round and didn't make too much of a fool of themselves in there. So I was going to go to the King George V for 2 or 3 weeks, and then to join Prince of Wales. The first problem was for me to find out where on earth was Scarpa Flow. So I had to get the atlas out and I look up the timetables, and I realised that you had to go up by train, that it would take over 24 hours, or about that, and then you had to take a ferry across the Firth and get to the Scarpa Flow and then get out to your ship. Now, one of the things we had been impressed upon in the when I was a cadet in Dartmouth was that when you joined your ship, you joined at 10 o'clock in the morning and you went to the officer of the watch and said, "Come aboard to join, sir." Well, this was all right for peacetime, you see. But, of course, things were getting a bit different in the war. However, I thought, well, I better try to get there for 10 o'clock, you see. So I looked up the timetables and I realised that the train arrived in Thurso at about 10 in the morning and the ferry went off at about 9:30 earlier. And so you just couldn't possibly get to the to Scarpa Flow that day. So I left that day previously. Luckily, I did so because I got to the King George V, which was, of course, a pretty big battleship, and you haven't seen one close to before, you think, golly, what a size. And there was a great deal of excitement going on because Mr. Churchill and Mrs. Churchill and Lord Halifax were there. And the ship was going to take Lord Halifax to Washington to be the ambassador to Washington, you see. Because I didn't know at the time that Halifax was being kicked out by Churchill because Churchill wanted to get rid of him because he was a prospective contestant for the premiership. But so there was Halifax looking his usual gloomy self, and Churchill there to see him off with quite a few top brass. Eventually, Churchill and Mrs. Churchill were, I think they'd all had a good lunch, and they all went off from the ship, and the ship sailed. My other friends from cadet days, who'd also been appointed to the King George V, took a more optimistic view of the timetables, and they'd left it to the day after. So they missed the boat, you know, more and spent the rest of the 3 weeks just stuck on board the depot ship, the Iron Duke, which was a bit of a letdown. As far as I was concerned, it was great, because we was all across the Atlantic, and one was able to find out about life aboard the ship.
What sort of introduction did they give you? Because you arrived knowing very little about being on the battleship. I mean, who took you under their wing?
Well, one of the senior midshipmen looked after me, I suppose. I can't remember who it was now. But there was also an instructor lieutenant carried in a ship like that. And, of course, there was a series of instructions. There was, you did navigation, practical navigation. You had to take star sights and sun sights, star sights at dawn and dusk and sun sights, and they work these out and present them to the navigator and do them again if you didn't get them right, which was a bit of a nuisance because in those days, you see, your aerial your star navigation was done with seven-figure logarithms. And there were a lot of logarithms to add up and subtract, and believe me, it was Inman's nautical tables and half log haversigns and things. I think they still do that, but of course, not many people have to use it these days. Anyway, so one did a fair amount of instruction, you see, and then you you had regular things like signaling exercises, and you'd go into one little office in the ship, and then the Morse code would start because the signal petty officer would be another one, and it'd be sending a test so that you'd be taking these down if you possibly could. But as a newcomer, it was all a bit strange. And then you understudied a midshipman on the watch, you see, because at sea you'd have a midshipman of the watch on the bridge who would help the officer of the watch, and then you can understudy him. So altogether, there was quite a lot to learn, and people to meet and that sort of thing.
Sorry, I was going to say, how did the crew on board? I mean, how did the other junior officers treat you? Were they still welcoming, or did you?
No, they were all welcoming. There was no problem there. You see, in the gun room, as it was, that's the midshipman's mess. The gun room was presided over by the sub-lieutenant. And so he was given the job of really looking after the young gentleman. But you also had an instructor lieutenant, and there was also a lieutenant commander who was known as the snotty's nurse. He was supposed to, keep an eye on things, you see, and, it worked pretty well. And in the King George V class, you had the wardroom, a deck above, which was quite a large mess, you see, for officers. You had the port, on the port side, lower down, you had the warrant officers mess. Those were the chief petty officers, who were the stalwarts of the ship, you might say, the warrant officers. And on the starboard side, you had the gun room, you see, for the midshipmen, you see. Different atmosphere, of course, in all of them, really, I suppose. I had a locker. You had a locker, and you kept your kit in that, and you were allowed to have beer or sherry, no spirits, which again had a bearing later on, and so eventually we got to Chesapeake Bay and Annapolis, where Lord Halifax was sent ashore in all pomp, you see, meaning trying to impress the Americans with British power. Oh dear, oh dear. However, that's all. So at Annapolis, of course, you have this big American Naval Academy, where they trained their midshipmen, who were really all midshipmen. They did a much deeper training at ashore than we did, you see. So that was understandable. But so you had all these people, the officers and midshipmen, who were invited out to fight it on board. Now these invitations were much sought after amongst the Americans, because you see American ships are dry, whereas British ships are not dry. So they could come aboard and have a plenty of drinks, you see, and etc. And so we entertained our parties of midshipmen, you see, and filled them up with sherry and beer, etc., which was fine. And they invited us back to Annapolis. Well, they couldn't give us drinks, but they could give us an enormous dinner. And, I mean, American food, well, it was, even then, as a midshipman, we thought it was marvelous. Mountains of ice cream to finish up with, we thought. And when we left, they were most generous. They said, oh, have all these. They had copies of Saturday Evening Post and Time, and they came aboard by the bundle, you see, and gramophone records of Bing Crosby, and, most generous. And they sent us off on our way. And, of course, to us, we were a ship at sea in wartime, and they were not at war. So there was a certain kudos.
So what did you feel about the Americans? I mean, they weren't in the war then. I mean,
no, they weren't.
What
and
was your attitude to America, as it were?
I mean, well, it wasn't critical by any means. It wasn't critical. I didn't know much about it then. I mean, obviously, one hadn't really knew much about it. I knew more later when I was when I met Churchill. But that was at the time, our attitude was certainly not critical. We hoped they'd come into the war, and they hoped they'd come into the war too. You see, but nothing more than that. And if anything, I think there was certainly a lot of envy on the part of the Americans that we were in and getting all the glory, and they were not.
So that was your first trip?
That was the first trip.
And then back to the UK?
Then it was back to the UK, and I had to join the Prince of Wales, which was actually at Rosyth. Now, the Prince of Wales was only recently commissioned, and it was a brand new, as the King George V, and as you know, the Prince of Wales was, the KG5 class, I must call them, was an entirely new design. They had heavy armour and high speed, and 10. That was a 4-gun turret forward. Above that was a 2-gun turret, and on the quarterdeck was another 4-gun turret.
I'll just stop you there. Graham Allen, end of reel 1.